Hello, this is Ali Gharib. I am a senior editor for Open Zion, and today I am talking with my friend Hussein. Hussein, go ahead and introduce yourself.
Sure. Well, apart from being a weekly Open Zion contributor, I'm also a senior fellow at the American Task Force on Palestine and a weekly columnist for Now Media, which is out of Lebanon, and for the national newspaper out of the UAE, among many other publications that I write for.
Yeah, a prolific author is Hussein Ibish.
I point people in the direction of the latest issue of The Baffler, which has a 6,000-word essay by me on the Marquis de Sade. So I'm not only a one-trick pony.
And a polymath, yeah.
Well, I don't know about that, but I write about various things.
Today we are going to talk about Egypt. There's been a lot of news out of Egypt in the past 2 months, but especially the past week.
Right.
And we're specifically going to talk about U.S. policy and what the U.S. should do.
Right.
Me and Hussein have taken very different tacks in our various publications that we write at.
Mm-hmm. And including Open Zion.
Including Open Zion, yeah,
which
exactly.
Has been really interesting and healthy and good.
Yeah, it is a forum for discussion after all.
Right, right.
So so why don't we maybe Hussein, you want to give a brief summary of just kind of very briefly what's happened over the past 2 months, and then a little bit about the past week.
That's that's asking for a lot. I mean, I mean, briefly, what's happened in Egypt is that the government of Mohamed Morsi became increasingly autocratic, even though it was elected in a free and fair election, and he scored a clear, although narrow, victory, but a very clear one, over the former Mubarak Prime Minister Ahmed Shafiq. It became increasingly autocratic, especially in a, and this was more than 2 months ago, but especially in a constitutional declaration where he accorded himself monarchical powers, medieval powers, powers not that weren't even claimed by Nasser or Sadat or Mubarak. That was rescinded, but still there was a sense that the Brotherhood was excluding all other groups, and discontent arose. So there was an effort beginning about 2 months ago, I think that's a pretty good starting point, to get the president to enter into some kind of conciliation. First, there were overtures by a number of parties, including the Salafist al-Nur party, that were rebuffed. Then there was this new group, Tamarrud Rebellion, which organized a 22 million or so, they claim, petition for him to hold new elections or form a national unity government or resign or, you know, basically any option for change that he would take, and he rebuffed that. Then many other parties requested change and tried to negotiate with him, and he really wouldn't negotiate with anyone, and he became more and more sort of aggressive in his defensiveness, and it appeared, I think, to many people in Egypt who were not who were becoming disillusioned with the Muslim Brotherhood, that what was in the works was a purge of the judiciary, a firing of the top third, the third 3,300 or so senior-most judges in the country, and sooner or later a move against the Ministry of the Interior and the security forces. I think all of this just came to a head with massive public demonstrations, possibly the largest in human history. Certainly even bigger than the ones against Mubarak, which is amazing, calling for something, you know, calling for change of some kind. And then the army intervened. Now, before they'd done that, I'd been publicly warning against a coup for reasons that are obvious. You don't want it, one doesn't want one, and it's not a good idea. What happened in Egypt, in my view, and we can certainly talk about this, it has every dictionary definition qualifying meaning of a coup, but it also had a whole lot more, because on the stage with General Abdel Fattah al-Sisi, when he announced Mubarak's ouster, was an entire cross-section of the rest of Egyptian political and socially engaged society. Al-Azhar, the Coptic Church, the 70-member National Salvation, a 70-party member, not 70-individual member, 70-party member National Salvation Front, that had been led but is no longer by Muhammad al-Baradei, the Salafist al-Nur party to the right of the Islamists, and pretty everybody except the Muslim Brothers and the former terrorist group Jamaa Islamiya. So you had a coup, but as I'd called it in the Daily Beast, a coup by acclamation. It is a very unusual coup, to say the least. Now, the brothers obviously rejected all this. So what you've had in the meanwhile, okay, is the emergence of two things. First of all, actual physical violent confrontation on a truly horrifying scale. On the one hand, at the sort of physical level, and a battle of narratives in Egypt on the other hand. And the physical battle has really been a campaign of repression by the new government against the brothers. The brothers' reaction was to launch protests, sit-ins, etc., they were not particularly violent at first, but they've become more violent as time has gone on. But they were attacked. They were told to disperse several times. They refused. And they were attacked,
right.
And first
over a period of 7 weeks, the sit-in lasted 7 weeks.
That's correct. So the first attack killed about 80 protesters and a couple of security people. The second one, 60 protesters and I think one security personnel. And then there was a big one where at least 400 or 500 and possibly much more than that protesters were killed. And then ongoing daily violence since then. Where we have at a minimum of 800 protesters killed, many of them unarmed, some of them women and children, and about 70 police personnel killed. That number also just increased with an attempted prison break yesterday, or a break from a prison vehicle in which 36 prisoners died. So in other words, you've had also hundreds, actually thousands, the word is thousands, thousands of Muslim Brother and their leaders and affiliated political figures have been arrested. So what you have then is a major campaign of repression by the authorities, and it's bloody and it's brutal and it's unconscionable. On the other hand, you also have a very nasty sectarian backlash from the Brotherhood and its supporters, blaming, in the narrative sense, the Coptic cabal, basically led by businessman Najib Sarawis, for this situation, and urging attacks on churches. Over 70 have been either destroyed or badly damaged, properties damaged, etc. Police stations attacked. There's been a lot of violence on the other side too, although, of course, disproportionate. The government has much more ability to conduct force, and possibly more interest as well. That's not clear. Who wants violence and why is not exactly clear to me at all. In fact, I actually believe both parties are egging each other on in a rather cynical way. But let's say that there's emerged a situation without any clean hands at all, in my view. So what we have then on top of that is a battle of narratives. The government and almost all of the Egyptian media, which, and there's been a great deal of censorship, which was obviously going to happen at the start of the first article I wrote for The Beast in the aftermath of the coup by acclamation, which I was certainly impressed by the unanimity behind. But I did say the one thing that was clear was that there was going to be a campaign of censorship, and I was disturbed by that. And there has been. The Egyptian media, mostly backing the government, has bought into the idea that this is a concerted campaign by the Muslim Brothers to take over the state, to destabilize it, and to impose their will.
To the point of
hysteria.
Of parroting the state's language.
Absolutely.
About calling the Muslim Brotherhood terrorists.
Terrorists, that's right. Yeah, no, to the point of hysteria.
And of course, it has been mostly The Egyptian media has been mostly parroting the government's narrative.
Absolutely.
And that's probably in large part because all the Islamist media was shut down in the immediate aftermath of the coup.
That's part of it.
In troubling circumstance.
Yeah, I think that's a big part of it. I also think, though, that there is a huge sort of deep reservoir yet of support for the military in, first of all, in the elites. And the media is not run by ordinary people, right? The media is run by middle-class people and above. And so I think in the middle class and above, there is a pretty strong reservoir, in spite of everything, for support for what the government's doing. And I'll demonstrate that in this way, which is that the parties that have not been banned, liberal parties, and there are dozens of them, parties that are not necessarily afraid to speak out, with very few exceptions, a couple of former NSF leaders, Albarrade and their spokesman, and one or two other exceptions, of the non-Islamist parties, they have all either been silent or have openly support, mostly have openly supported the government and the crackdown. So that there is a big constituency for what we in the West find so correctly so disturbing and happening in Egypt is pretty clear. Now there's also
I might even go so far as to say that that it's entirely possible that a majority of the population, not just the elites,
I think
are supportive of the military.
I think that's the way it looks. There's a pretty big majority in favor of this, which is itself unfortunate and disturbing, and yet here we are. There's one other thing I should mention, just to round out my thought. Because I know I've been talking nonstop, but you did ask me to summarize, so left me a little
the impossible bit. Task of a brief summary.
Well, I will just finalize by saying there is a Muslim Brotherhood narrative as well, which has a considerable body of support as well. At least 20% of the Egyptian population is either a member or of sympathetic to the Muslim Brotherhood. Minimum 18%. I can't imagine it's less than that. And it might be closer to 25, or it might be around 20. Sees what has happened as very simply a military coup against democracy. And they use the word legitimacy. And they see this as the return of the Felul, the old regime, the Mubarak regime, and simply that. And as counter-revolution, financed by Saudi Arabia, the UAE, and the Gulf, which they blame entirely for this, and that they are the vanguard of the revolution, and that they are fighting for freedom and justice and democracy, and that the other side is a gang of fascist thugs, and that they are the heroic martyrs and warriors for Islam. The only other thing to mention is that both sides firmly blame the United States and completely blame the United States, and the only group of people left in Egypt that don't seem to be absolutely hostile to the United States in every respect whatsoever is the military, which does continue to talk to the Americans. And other than that, Egyptian society can agree on only one thing. Whatever it is they don't like is the fault of the United States. And that's it.
Although even the military is not above sort of using, not as harsh as some of the other mm-hmm. factions in the country, but the military itself is not above confrontational rhetoric about America.
Sisi's interview
pumping up nationalism.
No, you're right. I mean, Sisi's interview in the Washington Post was angry against the United States, and unduly so, and in a demagogic way. He was pulling the nationalist card, and it was unseemly and unfitting and unfair.
Sorry. That is a great segue to talking about the American angle, and if I can just summarize basically what's happened here, is that in Washington you had, there's a long-standing relationship between the American government and the Egyptian military.
Mm-hmm.
This goes back decades from mm-hmm. when Egypt's military leaders turned their back on the Soviet Union, mm-hmm. turned towards America. There was a peace treaty with Israel that was brokered by Jimmy Carter.
Right.
And then the faucet was turned on for what has become the issue at hand today and what mm-hmm. we're really focused on talking
right.
about, which is the billions of American aid money, which now stands at about $1.3 billion a year
exactly
of direct
right.
aid to the Egyptian military.
Yeah. It should be said $250 million of that $1.3 billion is economic aid. And ironically,
I believe that comes out of a separate pot.
It might be.
The total is 1.5, and 1.3 of it is for the military.
Fair enough. That may be the right number, but I'm just noting the irony that it's the economic aid that's been completely cut, and the military aid that's been on some kind of a, ambiguous suspended basis. But anyway, do go on.
Yeah, so basically what happened was that There is an American law which is part of the Senate the House Appropriations Act for the State Department,
right,
which mandates that in the case of a military coup or mm-hmm. a coup ordered by the military or by a military mm-hmm. directive, that the aid to that military must be cut off,
right,
if that coup deposes a democratically elected leader,
mm-hmm.
That aid must be suspended until a time when the American government certifies that right. government has returned to democratic leadership.
Mm-hmm.
And so then this law sparked this really, really sort of, you know, incredible move by the Obama administration where they refused to label what had happened in Egypt a coup, because that would trigger the automatic cutoff. So their line all along for the past, you know, 2 months since the mm-hmm. since the coup has been that they refused to make a determination about yeah. whether or not this was a coup, thereby triggering the law.
Right.
So then that sparked lots of debate. You know, there's been various sure. positions.
Well,
there's been some funny political divides in the U.S. where mm-hmm. people on, for example, the neoconservative right
mm-hmm.
are divided on this. You know, right. somebody like Elliot Abrams has been advocating for cutting aid.
Yeah.
John McCain and Lindsey Graham have both flip-flopped two or three yeah. times on whether or not aid should be cut. You have, you know, the sort of
the
not quite internationalist. Let's call him. I'm hesitant to call him an isolationist because I don't think that's quite right. But the anti-internationalism of somebody like Rand Paul came to the fore.
Oh yeah, he wants to cut all aid. Amendment. Yeah, I mean he's against aid. You know, period.
Yeah, yeah, he's against most foreign aid, but he introduced yeah. an amendment to cut the aid to Egypt, and it led to this spirited
I think that got 13 votes. So that was
right.
A
it got 13
failure.
Votes. Yeah. There was, you know, and yeah. there was some news made during that Senate hearing because Lindsey Graham read aloud a letter from
right.
AIPAC saying that AIPAC opposed cutting off aid.
Well,
the Israeli government has been lobbying for the U.S. to keep aid.
Not a major
as have this as have the Saudis and
yeah.
the Emirates.
None of them major
bulwark have become kind of a bulwark
mm-hmm.
for the counter revolution
right.
in Egypt, and are incredibly supportive of the military. And so there's been this really kind of incredible debate. And then
mm-hmm.
you know there was a report last night, we were just talking about this before we started taping,
right.
from Josh Rogan
yeah.
who said that even though the administration has refused to make this designation, they've quietly mm-hmm. sort of frozen, not
right.
completely halted, but frozen all the remaining aid that hasn't been dispersed yet.
We knew
late last week there were a couple announcements about the
yeah.
State Department.
Yeah.
And so there's been this really incredible debate about whether aid should be continued or not, and
mm-hmm.
this is where you and I fall
yeah.
on different
so before
sides
we
of the
come,
divide.
Before we come to the direct question, let me just add a couple things to what you said. Yeah, Josh Rogan's piece is interesting. But it only confirms what we already knew, that there's a de facto suspension of many, many things. I mean, there was the cancellation of the Bright Star military exercises. There was a very strong diplomatic language the president used. He sort of strongly condemned and deeply deplored. There's nothing left in the diplomatic quiver in rhetorically after that. And then the withholding of the four fighter jets that were supposed to be delivered. And, I think we knew already that whatever aid for fiscal 13 was outstanding, which is about, it's less than a third of it. It's more like a quarter of it, if at most. It's less than $500 million, is not being delivered right now. And that's not a surprise at all. And all of these are, I would argue, completely reasonable measures under the circumstances. But the other thing I wanted, before we get to the question of what U.S. policy should be, and the real conundrum we do face, which I acknowledge is a very complicated one on values and interests, is the question of the coup. The question of, was this a coup? I mean, you called it an incredible step not to call it a coup. I actually think it was rational in two respects, and defensible in two respects. As I say, the military's action did meet any dictionary definition of a coup. However, I've never seen anything like it before. I've never seen a coup d'état which is, you know, led by the military, which was supported by every other political group in the country except the party being deposed. I mean, it was just extraordinary the amount of backing that it had. And you've got to pay attention also to the demonstrations that came before it. And as you say, there's every reason to suspect that there's still a solid majority in Egypt behind all of this. So that's an unusual situation. And I'm not sure either. I think even though something may fit a very set dictionary definition, it may be such an anomalous example of one that it's very hard to label it as such. And so I think that this is not a garden variety coup, an obvious coup, or something that is simply a coup. So that's the first thing. That's not even to take into consideration reasons to avoid that language for practical questions. Now we'll get to that. The other thing that I wanted to mention is the question of democratically elected. So that would be the rationale for the U.S. not to have had that reaction to the overthrow of Mubarak, which was also a coup. It was nothing but a coup. In fact, it was very similar. It was a coup that was in response to massive public pressure to remove a government that had lost its legitimacy. The argument would be, well, Morsi was elected democratically, and Mubarak was a dictator, or he was running an autocracy. Fine. Mubarak was elected in a free and fair election, but Mubarak was not presiding over a democratic system, and he was not ruling democratically. So it is, again, I think it would be very difficult to describe Egypt under Morsi as a democratic system. There was an election, but that does not make it a democracy, and it was not a democracy. So again, it's not so simple.
Yeah, but that's not that what. The way that Mohamed Morsi was elected, Hussein, is mm-hmm. totally not comparable to the way Hosni Mubarak was
elected. I agree with that. I mean,
we're talking
two
totally different
things. I agree.
The notion that we should have cut off aid to... But maybe I misunderstood, but you said that the removal of Mubarak removed a democratic... an elected leader
No. You did misunderstand me. Let me make it clear. Mubarak was simply an autocrat. He was simply a dictator. There's no democratic anything. That's clear. What I'm suggesting is that obviously the law didn't apply, right? So we agree on
yes,
that.
Yes,
okay,
that's right.
That's fine.
That's the point.
I agree with that, and that's what I said. What I say is that what's more complicated is to apply that term to the government of Morsi. Because while he was elected in a free and fair election, a free and fair election does not constitute the establishment of a democracy. And it was not a democracy that he was running. He was running what was increasingly an autocratic system, and there was no constitution in place. He was ruling by extra-constitutional decrees, and although he was elected, he was not democratic. And it is not enough. It is a typical mistake, I think, particularly among Arab Islamists at the moment, which needs correcting, to equate elections with democracy. They are not the same thing. Let me finish my thought. Democracies are a sine qua non of election. Elections are a sine qua non of democracy. You can't have democracy without elections. But an election alone does not a democracy make, and that was not a democracy.
Well, I agree with the broader points, but it seems clear to me that despite the autocratic moves by the Morsi government and some of his mm-hmm. his worst anti-democratic tendencies, that the system, by and large, was functioning as a severely flawed democracy, especially in the bigger picture, and less so with some of his more recent actions,
which spurred
the popular unrest against him.
Yeah, but you know who disagreed with you was the Egyptian people.
That's the problem. Exactly, just as I said, especially later in the time, yeah.
So, yeah. He lost his legitimacy, that's for sure. And there was no way to recall him.
Can I just... Hussein, please, you're not letting me finish my thoughts.
I'm sorry. I really am sorry about that.
I don't think that you can fairly make the comparison. I mean, it seems... You know, you're making an argument here that I think it seems quite obvious to me that it's sort of jumping through hoops to avoid making mm-hmm. this... this coup designation and triggering
I don't think so.
This law. And you know, I'm just I don't think that argument holds that much water. But you know, we've been talking
Explain to me why? Because I forget about Mubarak. Just look at Morsi. I'm saying he was elected, but that doesn't mean that he was presiding over a democratic system, and it doesn't mean that he hadn't lost his legitimacy, and there was no other option for the entire rest of Egyptian society that was there at that podium, from his religious right to the Al-Azhar to the Coptic Church.
You know, there were parliamentary elections coming up in October. And
maybe or maybe not.
Maybe or maybe not, right. But that proposition could never be tested because
they weren't willing to wait anymore.
Unseated the democratically elected
leader. But it wasn't just the military. This is what you're missing. First, it was the Tamarod. Then it was the demonstrations, and then it was the entire group that stood behind the military saying, we agree with this, and just to quote Sheikh Al-Azhar, he said, I don't like this idea of a coup, I'm here because this is the better of two terrible options. And I think that that's the extent to which that was and remains a widespread sentiment in Egypt ought to be taken into very strong consideration.
Yes, I think that that's to an extent true, but I have trouble escaping the fact that, you know, that this was indeed a coup. I mean, you said it yourself, a coup by acclamation, but a coup by acclamation, it's implicit. I mean, the word is right there that it's still a coup.
But, okay, fine.
And, you know, it wasn't, this council didn't release a joint statement. It was Sisi that stood up and said that, you know, the elected leader of Egypt was no longer the leader of Egypt.
But then they all
It seems even more clear since then, especially given the way that the Egyptian military has acted, that this is not that the Egyptian army is not exactly acting on the inclusive will of its people either. But as you said, somewhere around a quarter of the population is being
the country is badly divided,
quite badly persecuted,
right. Horribly
persecuted.
I agree with that.
No.
I agree with that. I just want to make one point clear that in case I haven't. Which is that, everybody else on that stage was supportive of this action, which means that it was not simply a military coup. I mean, the question of the coup against Mubarak was definitely a coup, but it didn't trigger the law, because it wasn't a coup against a democracy. The question in this case is not whether this was a coup or not, but what kind of coup was it, and was it a coup against democracy, and is it sufficient to trigger that law? Is it wise for us to trigger that law? Does it make sense for the United States? Does it make sense for Egypt? Does it make sense in the context of our strategic relationship? Which brings us to the crux of our question.
That's not how laws work.
Yes, it is.
Laws don't work on the basis of whether they're wise or not. Laws work on the basis of adherence to the law.
Actually, it is. First of all, when laws are applied, there is such a thing as prosecutorial discretion. And secondly, you can call something whatever you like. I mean, you know, in other words, I will agree that the coup against Mubarak was a coup and didn't trigger the law because Mubarak was not democratic. I will not agree that what happened, although it has the elements of a coup against Morsi, triggers the law automatically because I don't believe Morsi was governing democratically. That's a very important distinction. He was not. He may have been elected, but he was not governing
democratically. I agree that there were definitely some issues, but I think that that despite those issues, there was certainly some of the underpinnings of what you could call it a democratic system there. And I'm not sure. I'd have to check double check the language of the law. I believe the law says that it's about it's the deposing of a democratically elected
right. Right, and I don't believe there was a democracy in place in Egypt. I don't accept it.
You don't think the election was even democratic?
The election was free and fair, but an election does not make a democracy. No, democracy is not 50% plus one. Democracy requires division of powers, which Morsi was ignoring. It requires many different branches of government. It requires respecting minority and individual individual rights, which is not happening, and it's not happening now either, frankly. And we have another fundamental disagreement.
That's much more to my point, which hopefully we're getting to.
Let's go there now. Go ahead. Go for it.
So I think that the U.S. has a responsibility at this point to cut off its aid to the Egyptian military. That's something that that you obviously disagree with.
I do.
Do you want to go first with your reasons why it should happen?
No. I've done too much. I've dominated too much. You speak.
Okay. Well, so this is basically the outline of it. Now, I agree that Morsi's. You know, as we just discussed, I think that the law is pretty clear on this, and I think that what happened pretty clearly fits into the definition. You don't agree with that, that's fine. We can move on to the next issue, which is that last week we had this massacre on August 14th of the Muslim Brotherhood sit-in protest. This was a raid on a largely peaceful protest. And by the way, international human rights law, I spoke to a human rights lawyer about this. Even if some protesters are within a protest are armed, and even if some of the protesters within a protest are doing things like throwing rocks at the military, that does not change the status of the overall protest as a peaceful demonstration.
Fine.
And I think that when you look at most of the videos of the sit-ins before the crackdown, that was largely the case.
Security
forces come in, and this largely peaceful protest is massacred. There were reports that the free passage that the military had promised for those protesters that want to go home was denied. There was indiscriminate fire.
Well, at least one of the sit-ins was entirely dispersed through free passage. So that there's a mixed record on that.
Yeah, but the larger protest.
The larger
was
protest,
not,
and, yeah, not until the very
and,
end. Yeah.
And between the two, there was a large number of people killed.
Right, and it's outrageous.
Yeah, somewhere
it's unacceptable.
The Interior Ministry's own figure, I believe, was 638.
Right, with 26 security killed as well. That's right.
Yeah, that's right. Thereabouts is right.
Yeah,
and
that's
so
it.
Just to point out what I think is the moral travesty of the Egyptian military's actions, I would point out that, you know, I was looking through a BBC website list of the bloodiest days in Syria's brutal and completely disgusting and destructive civil war there, and no single day in Syria's civil war has reached the death toll that was reached in the army's crackdown on the Muslim Brotherhood sit-in protest.
On that one day. Yeah, because Assad has been extremely clever in having a quota. By the way, you do understand that's been one of the key pillars of his strategy. He doesn't let his military kill more than X number of people on any given day. It's a very important, it's a key element of his strategy. You still have the number of 100,000.
So these are two different things. I don't think a make or break for my case.
No,
I'm just
not
saying
at all.
That by way. It's an important point that this is an incredibly brutal act.
Yes. Well, but we don't dispute that, so it's stipulated. It was horrible. And it was probably a mistake. I mean, it will probably, have worse effects than if it hadn't been done.
To my mind, there's not much of a probably there.
I'm not 100% sure. It depends on what you want. For the purposes I'm interested in, it cannot do any good. And yes, it was terrible. I don't know what the military strategy is. So in their case, they may or may not get what they want. Let me tell you something. I see both sides trying to goad each other into excesses in pursuit of, in the military sense, mainly domestic support, which they're winning, and in the Muslim Brotherhood sense, to some extent domestic support. They're not making any progress there, but they're going for international support and sympathy. And they're winning a lot of it. And that's their present strategy. And it's working well for both sides. The military, I think, is doing very well with its narrative domestically. And I think the brothers are doing very well with their narrative internationally. And I think that they're trying to goad each other into ever more you know, excesses, and I think they're cooperating with you know. I don't see either side looking to back down here. They're both finding this to be, under the current circumstances, a confrontation worth pursuing. Nobody's looking for a deal.
I think that's right at this point. Yeah. I'm not sure how you could expect after the crackdown for the Brotherhood to look for the deal, and I think that the military wasn't.
Well, if they had any sense, they would, but they don't have any sense, so of course I don't expect that.
Yeah, and we don't need to get into it because we got into a long talk about it on Twitter yesterday.
That's
fine. There was reports indicating that there was a potential confidence-building deal. You think that this was spin after the fact?
No, I don't know. I think that there are multiple reports from different credible sources, and it's not clear. That's what I think.
Yeah. Okay. Fair enough. So,
that's all I think.
So basically, the nuts of my argument are that, in addition to the legal requirement, which I think is triggered and you don't,
right?
I think that at some point there has to be, there has to be a moral imperative to say, listen, we cannot support this.
Yes.
Look, the Egyptian military is a Egyptian institution that we have supported with billions of dollars. We have given them money so that they could buy back weapons to us. And there's no doubt we have some national interests in Egypt, but I think that they're often overstated for the purpose of the argument. But I think that let me finish here.
Of course.
But I think that it's impossible to countenance the type of crackdown that is happening against the Muslim Brotherhood, with its leaders being arrested, mass killings. There's been vigilantes set up. And it's impossible to countenance that with American values and with morals.
Right.
And frankly, our $1.3 billion pays about a fifth of Egypt's estimated military budget. That is just far too large a piece for the U.S. to be contributing to one side of this conflict.
Okay.
You know, Obama, in his comments last Thursday after the massacre, said, "We don't pick sides in Egypt." That's a patently false statement. This conflict is between the military government and the Muslim Brotherhood, and one of those two players gets $1.3 billion a year for us. I mean,
that's about the state. I mean, look, the military is not going away. I think you're misinterpreting.
Hold on, let me finish here.
All right.
In this world, money talks, and our money has clearly shown that we take the side of one piece in this conflict.
Yeah.
And I think that it's time to wash our hands of this travesty. I mean, we can't continue to support this.
Okay.
My moral case.
Fine.
Okay,
now you go ahead. Well, I'll come to the moral question in a second because it is the crucial question. And it's extremely important. But let me just say, the support to the Egyptian military is support to a state institution with which we have had, you know, this very important strategic relationship. And so the question is, and it's the underpinning of the Egyptian-Israeli peace treaty. It has to do with the preferential treatment in the Suez Canal, intelligence sharing. There are all kinds of different, you know, major reasons, gains the United States gets out of this strategic relationship that we have. And so the question really is, what is the threshold for placing that in mortal peril? Not for dissociating ourselves with the actions of Egypt's government. We needed to do that, and we did do that through diplomatic rhetoric, through a de facto suspension of aid, as you say, which is going on, withholding of weapons delivery, canceling of joint military exercises. Quite a bit has been done here to express American values. The question is, at what point do we abandon our interests? That's the question. All right. Have we crossed that threshold? You say yes, and I say no, for some very important reasons. First of all, the Egyptian military doesn't need our $1.3 billion a year. That is, to a very large extent, I mean, it's important. The spare parts and services that they get are important. But they can do without the United States. They really can. I mean, they are not an unimportant country. Their importance is not exaggerated. If you think it is, ask Rashid Ghannouchi in Tunisia, who's freaking out right now, or ask Benjamin Netanyahu in Israel, or anybody in the Persian Gulf, or the Arabian Gulf, as they call it. You know, it is not an unimportant country. Ask anyone who's engaged in shipping.
Let me just interrupt for one second, Hussein.
Sure.
I object to Arabian Gulf.
Fine. I don't care. I grew up with Persian Gulf. I'm perfectly fine with it. Or ask any aircraft carrier commander or anyone engaged in commercial shipping. Now, Egypt is a very big, very influential country. And I like Bobby Ghosh, and I've only seen one article by him that I thought was really terrible, and it was the one yesterday or the day before that in Time where he said Egypt just isn't that important. This is wrong. This is a misapprehension. It's not as important as it was in the 50s, but neither is Russia, neither is the United States for that matter. It's still very important, so is Russia and the United States, at different registers of importance, but still it's hugely important. Now, the question is, where is the threshold? First of all, let me just come back to it for a second. The Obama administration's approach to the Middle East is neither a kind of straightforwardly liberal one, nor is it a traditionally realist one. It's one that identifies interests and values and tries to balance them. And that was best articulated.
I agree.
It was best articulated in the Libya speech, right? You remember the speech about Libya where he said, yep, we're interests and values. That means that you have to weigh the moral imperatives of your actions against your strategic interests and the value you get out of a strategic relationship. So we've had very different reactions. In Libya, there was no strategic relationship and no reason not to intervene, and we did, and it was sound. It was a perfect harmony between interests and values, especially as we did nothing to try to take over Libya or dominate it, but left it to the Libyans, who are having a very tough time sorting things out, but it's not our problem. The pottery barn rule of Colin Powell never kicked in because we didn't put any open American boots on the ground. It was all remotely and just to help the Libyans get rid of a hated dictator. In Syria, there is a great strategic concern, but it's not about Syria itself. It ought to be, but it isn't at this point. It's conceived as of regional stability, the countries immediately surrounding it, which is why there's been such risk aversion in Syria and such a hesitancy to get more involved in funding the right people in Syria, which has allowed Al-Qaeda, far too much space. And thankfully, that's being reversed and in a fairly effective and decisive way, but mainly by some of our partners. If we only had values and didn't have interests, we'd have a very different relationship with Saudi Arabia and with what happened in Bahrain and with the question of the Bahraini opposition and all of that. But we do have interests, I don't think with the Emirates, frankly, that much. But I think that with many countries around the world, with Colombia, with plenty of countries in Africa, with some East Asian countries, and with China, and with Russia, which we quarrel with, but we have diplomatic relations with them. If we had only interests, our foreign policy would look radically different. But we do have, if we had only values, rather, our foreign policy would look very different. But we have actually got strategic interests. Now, I've laid out in an article in The National about 7 or 8 major reasons why the United States Egypt's strategic relationship is still worth preserving, under the conditions that we agree are terrible and unacceptable. And so what I think is that the administration has actually struck a good balance by articulating in both word and deed our very strong objection to the way this is being handled without fundamentally placing that strategic relationship at risk, and that, I think, is the wise and sensible approach.
Okay, so here's the thing. So my problem is that I don't think that the words and the deeds of the administration, which have been really small. I loved Tom Guerra, the Wall Street Journal writer's tweet when Obama canceled the military exercise. He said Obama cancels brunch with the Egyptian army. I mean, I think that's sort of on the level that we're talking here, like canceling a joint exercise, and I have to concede that quietly freezing this aid is a better first step,
okay,
than just the sort of rhetorical outlays. But I really do stand by the notion that we have to wash our hands.
Let me ask you this.
I do think it's a real moral travesty. But can we run down your list of strategic interests real
quick?
I believe you had those as the flyover rights for the American military, preferential treatment
in the Suez Canal.
In the Suez Canal, the Egyptian-Israeli peace treaty,
intelligence
and,
sharing,
intelligence cooperation,
mm-hmm.
the Sinai,
yes,
and that's five of them. What else? What am I missing here?
Those
are the big ones.
There's
right?
There's also the fact that it would be ineffective. Okay, so we would simply be losing whatever little leverage we do have, which you could say
right.
has proven ineffective, but actually there is still contact on a daily basis between the Egyptian military and the United States, and that's
but
worth
But
something.
Contact is not synonymous with leverage, right? I mean,
it,
that's
it can't, well, in the immediate term, when people think things are existential, no. And that's the way both the brothers and the anti-brotherhood coalition or the pro-government coalition see things. So no, when it's existential, no. But when it's not existential, yes. And there will be moments when we have serious issues that are not viewed as, you know, existential, and they will listen to us. They've listened to us in the past on many things, and they will again. And the question I have for you is, there are many other aspects to this relationship. I think the list is of less importance than simply asking you if you think that the strategic relationship with Egypt is really just not very important to the United States. Do you really believe that?
I think Bobby Losh overstated his case, but yeah, I don't think it's as important as it need to be. I think that the Sinai is mostly an Israeli interest. I think the Egyptian-Israeli peace treaty is mostly an Israeli interest. I mean, the U.S. does have some overarching interests in regional stability, but at what cost? Probably, I think the most significant one is preferential treatment at the Suez Canal. But as I pointed out on Twitter to you the other day, we just have to wait a few hours.
No, it can
like
be
all
more
the
than
other convoys. Wait,
it can be much more than a few hours. It can be days. It can cost
days,
billions.
Okay.
It can cost billions.
Is that worth having blood on our hands?
Well,
I don't think so.
I don't think we do have blood on our hands. Look. Here's the problem. You're talking as if this were a unique situation, right? You're talking as if we didn't do this kind of evaluation necessarily because we are a great power all the time, right? Where we have governments with which we have strategic relationships doing things we don't approve of. And we say we don't approve of them sometimes much less loudly and much less clearly than we've said so now. And maybe that's appropriate. I don't have any objection to any of the steps that have been taken at all. And indeed, there might be further ones that I would find appropriate. What I think is that everything should be done to preserve that strategic relation. I don't see anybody here calling for a break off of diplomatic relations with Saudi Arabia. Or with China, or with any of the other countries around the world where a very similar argument could be made based on either their domestic or foreign policies. I don't see that because
but
it makes
I'm
no
not
sense.
Talking about breaking off diplomatic relations. I'm talking about stopping funding
about,
to the people
yeah,
who are
true.
Killing their own citizens.
But you're talking about
we don't
ending...
fund the Saudi army and their oppression. And we certainly don't fund the Chinese and their repression.
Well, actually, you're wrong in both cases. It's not funding. It's a question in both those cases of strategic cooperation. We certainly sell the Saudis all the weapons that they have and have been crucially involved in the Gulf. We are the major player
and
in the Gulf.
I'm a long-standing critic of arms deals with Saudi Arabia because
that's
of their... unpalatable foreign policy. But then, I'm a moralist.
You know,
I'm a moralist and a liberal, and so these are the positions that I take.
Well, that's fine. I'm a liberal too, but I'm a liberal who lives on planet Earth, and I understand. I'm not implying you don't. I'm just saying that I think I'm rather grounded in the idea that the policy establishment here in Washington, in the government, the people who have the responsibility, the executive branch, who have the responsibility for the consequences of U.S. foreign policy, have to think about what the costs of inaction are. Now, is there a threshold? Of course there is. If we were considering
hypothetically,
behavior,
what would it
I'm
be?
Getting, I'm getting it. I'm going to give it to you.
Okay.
The great example is the way that Russia is behaving in Syria. In other words, providing heavy weapons on a massive scale to a family-led mafia regime that is operating a sectarian civil war using heavy weapons to massacre civilians from one end of the country to another that has displaced a huge percentage of the population and in which over 100,000 people have died. Now, if we were in that situation, For sure. Not only I wouldn't countenance it, and I wouldn't want to have anything to do with it. I would want to cut off diplomatic relations with that country and have absolutely, you know, and fund the opposition if possible. If I could find anyone in the opposition worth funding, and I think they're there in Syria. So, I mean, I think that, in other words, for the United States to behave in Egypt as the Russians have been in Syria would be unconscionable, but Russia is not, the United States is not behaving like Russia, and Egypt is not Syria. So I don't actually believe that we do have blood on our hands. We have repudiated this. We have made our displeasure clear in word and deed. It may not be enough for you, but it is a lot more than has been done in other situations, and a lot more than, say, Syria has done in Russia, which is instead has promoted this gigantic sectarian massacre that's going on there, which is a very different, you know, these things operate on totally different moral registers. Is what's happening in Egypt repulsive? Yes. But what's happening in Syria is a historical calamity, and those are two different things.
Okay, well, let me make another piece of my case here, and that's sure. That the path that the Egyptian military is pursuing is one that necessarily involves the very same sins which the Muslim Brotherhood was guilty of, and one which is setting back, further setting back, any sort of democratic transition in Egypt. I mean, I don't think we can expect, certainly the military's initial timeline of transitioning back to democracy in 6 months has been blown completely out of the water. And you know, that it might have been a non-starter from the beginning because of the Muslim Brotherhood's initial intransigence, but at this point, it has become a campaign of repression against what could be a quarter of Egypt's population. It is impossible to have an inclusive democratic government under those circumstances, and the Egyptian military, as is quite clear in the week since the massacre, is only further entrenched in that position every day. The rhetoric about the Muslim Brothers as terrorists continues. Mm-hmm. Yeah. The crackdown continues. The arrests of its leaders continue. Yeah. I mean, this is nothing good coming of this.
Here we are not in disagreement, okay? And I've written that in my articles. If you read my articles before, during, and after, you'll know that that's what I think too, right? And in fact, you do know that because you've edited them.
I do read your articles.
Well, because you edit them, in some of them anyway, the ones for The Beast. And that's mainly where I write about Egypt, is mainly in The Beast. So you know that I think that. And in addition, there was one in now Lebanon 2 days before the overthrow of Morsi saying a coup is not an answer. Now, I did have to reevaluate when I saw the people on the stage and the consensus behind it. But, I mean, it's complex. But the point is, I do agree with you that this is no way forward. And I think that both sides are, as I said, neither side is interested in a deal. Both sides look to me like they're trying to goad each other into ever greater excesses because, while we've dwelt a lot on what the government, and it really hasn't been the military, by the way. It's not, let's not confuse people. Let's be clear. It's not soldiers that are doing this. It's not the military that's doing it. It's a government led by the military to some extent, but also by some others.
Hussein, that is obfuscating what is happening. Well, it's the security services under the order of a military-led government.
Yes, right.
I mean, let's not make any bones about this. There's a state of emergency.
Look, that's right. That's right.
From de facto military rule to de jure military rule.
Well, I think that's right. But it's still an important point to note that what's being done is being done, and this is important because of Egyptian domestic politics, which is, you know, something I'm interested in anyway, which is that it's being done by the security forces, right? And the security forces, by the way, were absolutely convinced that in the run-up to the ouster of Morsi, he was preparing a purge not only against the judiciary, which was being planned publicly, he was preparing a purge of the Ministry of the Interior and the security forces as well. So these are mortal enemies, and I don't see them as being interested in either side in making a deal. And the battle of narratives, as I say, is what's taking place. So I agree with you that there aren't any clean hands here at all. And we've dwelt a lot on the excesses of the government. But let's look at what the Brotherhood has done. The Brotherhood has emphasized its desire for martyrdom and bloodshed, and its desire to be martyred and bloodied. And that was there before anything happened. In Morsi's last two speeches, his main theme was legitimacy versus non-legitimacy, meaning I got 51% or 50% plus one, therefore I get to do whatever I want. Plus, how much he wanted to shed his own life and blood, etc. And he kept doing that. And the response, that's no justification for giving people what they want. They shouldn't be given that, even if to some extent they might at least rhetorically say they want it. No, it has no justification for this whatsoever. But the response has been a kind of a pogrom against Christians. By Muslim Brotherhood inspired forces, and it's been as ugly as sin, and increasing violence on the part of Muslim Brothers. So I think both parties might be engaged in an effort to try to get the others to behave as badly as possible, right, in order to win, in the military's term, more domestic, and the Brotherhood's term, I think they're looking more international, especially Western, public opinion. And I think both parties are doing quite well by it so far. Although, I would say that the state's ability to survive a long-term standoff is much greater than the Brotherhood's. Yeah, on the other hand, we agree on one thing. We do agree on one thing, that the Brotherhood is not going to go away. It's not going to vanish. It's a part of Egypt's society. And at some point, you're going to have to find a way to reincorporate them into a peaceful political system. And every day that goes by with this confrontation going on, makes that more and more difficult, and it's a great tragedy. And I will give you this, that at the moment, the government having more of the cards, the onus is more on them to come up with conciliatory measures than it is on the Brothers. The question is, are the Brothers interested and ready to listen? I doubt it, but that doesn't relieve the government of its responsibility. So I think you could agree on that.
The government has more power and therefore more responsibility.
I think that's right.
And, you know, I would argue that that once again returning to the American aid issue, mm-hmm. is that you have to remember that I agree that both sides are behaving really badly, but we're only funding one of those sides.
Yeah,
and I know you don't think that that's necessarily quite as, you know, I don't think you quite feel that that gives the U.S. the same level as complicity
I
do.
I don't see it the same way in a couple of ways. There's that. I don't see it in that way, but I see it as something else. It's funding the Egyptian military to do certain things that do not involve killing protesters. And I don't think any of the money, except for the fact that money is fungible, none of the U.S. aid is linked to the kinds of weaponry or systems or communication or anything like that that's been involved in the repression. It is for...
No, but that's exactly the point of saying is that money is fungible.
Well, okay,
and when
then.
We pay a fifth of their budget,
sure, well, then.
We're giving them room to do other things.
And what, you know,
empower themselves as they always have.
Well,
the system worked under Mubarak, too, right? You had the regime
Also under Morsi. I mean, my bottom line is, look, the United States deals, because it has a strategic relationship with Egypt, it deals with and will continue to deal with almost any government that comes to power. It dealt with Mubarak, it dealt with SCAF, it dealt with Morsi, and it dealt now with Mansour and Sisi. And that is because what we are funding is the Egyptian state, its ability to defend itself on its borders, the question of Sinai, and the overall power of the Egyptian military as a fighting force in the biggest sense, not on the streets of Cairo or Alexandria or Port Said, where they haven't been present.
It's right, but this is something I mentioned in my piece about Obama's inane taking sides comment, was that when we dealt, you know, that as you've said, both sides are most factions mm-hmm. in Europe. I mean, you're right that the military's rhetoric isn't quite as harsh as other factions, but mm-hmm. the rhetoric is still there.
It's there.
But when people always say that, like, everybody blames us for everything, mm-hmm. that's true, except for the fact that our dealings with the Muslim Brotherhood government were the same as dealings we would have with any government where we had diplomatic relations. But even at the time when we were having those dealings with the Muslim Brotherhood, our funding was not going to the Muslim Brotherhood government. I mean, there were other programs.
It was going to the military. It was going to the military with which they were in partnership. With which they were in partnership.
All along, yes, all along we have been funding the military.
Right.
That aid wasn't transferred back from Morsi's government to the military. It just stayed where it was.
Where it has always been and where it is going to stay. And I think it would be a very interesting proposal, actually, once we had an Egyptian government that we were happier with, and I'm sure that that day will come sooner rather than later, to begin to... I think so. I'm quietly confident about that, but nobody knows. To start to either increase aid to include more economic aid, not less, or start shifting the burden of aid. I don't know. But I mean, I think that's worth looking at. The point is, though, you do have to understand how many Egyptians and other Arabs believe that the United States, and they're absolutely convinced of this, it's almost impossible to talk them out of it because I try to do it all the time, that the United States was very pro-Muslim Brotherhood, that the United States was instrumental in getting Morsi into power and tried to keep him there, and is trying to get him back, which is the most ridiculous of all. And I think
because
that, hold on,
no,
let me just
military that's
it mastering. Is it's an absurd conspiracy theory, but so is the idea, I think, that we are somehow behind this government and what it's doing, or that we were complicit in the coup or complicit in what they're doing because of an aid program that dates back to the Egyptian-Israeli peace treaty and is designed to achieve a number of very clear, very important American strategic goals that have nothing to do with what's going on. So the question is, would it be an overreaction to take a purely moral point of view on this, and without doing that in other cases around the world? I mean, if this were really the foreign policy of the United States, that we simply acted on our values without any concern for our interests, then fine, then no doubt, and then we would have to reevaluate our relationship with at least half the countries in the world. If it's not, then I don't think Egypt crosses that threshold yet, and I'm fairly confident that it's not going to, but I certainly hope not.
No, I mean, you know, I don't think that I'm calling for strictly a moral foreign policy, but I do think that values are important, and I think
in this case
that our outlay has been so huge on this that it's hard not to say something like, it's impossible to look at the situation and say that we are continuing to support the Egyptian military even when they're massacring their own people, because the dollar amount is simply so large. Tom, let me finish real quick.
Okay,
and
sure.
I recognize these strategic interests, but I think that they are, in this case especially, outweighed by the actions that the military has taken repeatedly.
Fine.
And outweighed by the moral case that we need to wash our hands of it and be rid of it.
There's two problems. Hold on, before you're done, let me just
say there are two
quick problems with that. Number one is that would be a very convincing argument if the aid program had been initiated recently. But it hasn't. It's very, very long-standing. It dates decades back, and it's based on all kinds of other things.
Right.
So we'd
have to think about those other things. It supported Egyptian repression against its own people.
Well, I mean, you can look at it that way if you want, but that was not the intended purpose, nor was it the primary effect of that aid. Look, Egypt does not rely on that $1 billion to repress its people when it's doing that. It just doesn't, you think too much of it. It's like that line from The Godfather. You think too much of me, kid. You know, that money is not the central feature in Egyptian domestic politics.
You wrote this in your national piece that if the U.S. aid leaves, that there will be other actors
come
and rush to fill the breach.
Yes.
Now, I think that's probably true, but you know what? I'm much less concerned with the moral travesties supported by Saudi Arabia, which are many, than I am with the moral travesties that are supported economically by the United States.
As I said,
the idea that somebody else will rush in to fill the money ignores that there's American agency
right.
in what we do. It's Bernard Williams and Jim and the Indians, you know?
As I also said in that piece, if the United States wants to wash its hands of Egypt and wash away, it can do that and walk away. It can do that. I was just trying to lay out the price. And I think that by the way, the initial reaction in Washington was very consistent with what you're laying out. And I think that on second thought, many, many more people, I was a very lonely voice when I wrote that piece. And several people have told me it took a good deal of courage to write it. And frankly, I knew, I didn't feel very courageous. I didn't take any courage to write, but I knew that it was going to be very much disliked by most people in Washington, and it has been. And that's fine. But I think you can see a shift further in my direction of, wait a minute, on second thought, maybe that's not such a hot idea. And let me just say that not only is that military aid very old and based on other considerations and has not been funding, except for the fact that money is fungible, repression of Egyptians. The second thing is that you talk as if nothing has been done. Now, it's not, what's been done obviously is not sufficient to your tastes, but it's not
That's
as
right.
if the United States has simply done nothing. It has said and done quite a lot, and I'm glad of that, and you don't think it's gone far enough, and I point to the cost of going much, you know, going so far as to wreck a strategic relationship that's been very valuable. And I would simply continue to advocate that the U.S. should promote aggressively its values, but try to preserve what is a mutually beneficial relationship between two important countries. And Egypt is an important country to us. And that's all I think.
Yeah. Okay, so let me just ask you one question. I mean,
sure.
we've been going on for more
and
than
And we can
an hour,
wrap up with this.
So we should
yeah.
probably wrap it up, yeah.
Sure, absolutely.
So you say you're quietly optimistic that Egypt will return to some kind of normalized government.
Well, I kind of have to
democracy.
Be.
Yeah, I think so too. I wonder if the Egyptian military continues on its current course and continues this campaign of repression, and we end up with basically what we had for the better part of the last three decades, which is an autocratic dictatorship, which is supported by U.S. funds, which aren't maybe the most important thing in the world to this autocratic dictatorship, but nonetheless remain an important point of legitimacy for it on the world stage. Is there either a time period or, you know, if the military's intent to never turn back to civilian democratic rule became clear, is there anything like that that would cause you to change your mind and say that, listen, our strategic interests are important, but we cannot continue to support this in an ongoing and open-ended way?
Yeah, I mean, definitely there's a point. And it's very hard to pinpoint exactly where it would be. And it's all got to be done on a case-by-case basis and depending on the regional circumstances. So
obscenity, you'll know it when you see it.
Yeah, it's like pornography, you'll know it. Yeah, or obscenity, yeah. You'll know it when you see it. Yeah, I think so. And I think that, you know, you can give a hyperbolic answer and say, well, behaving like Syria and Russia. Behaving like Russia and Syria, excuse me. But I think more, there's a more serious answer to your question, which is that, yeah, at some point, it may get too bloody and too autocratic to want to have anything to do with, depending on the overall circumstances. It also depends a lot on the behavior of the Muslim Brothers. It depends a lot on many different factors. And I think we can and should continue to demand that the military cease repression, continue to condemn the attacks on churches and the some of the counter-brutality of the Muslim Brotherhood, and stop kidding ourselves that these are Democrats or reasonable people, which they're not. And at the same time, you know, try to get pressure all sides to get civilian rule back. You have a nominal civilian rule by Adel Mansour, but that's no good. You need a proper election, free, fair, and open. And one of the things that needs to be done is to find a way this can't unfortunately be done in the short run, but in the medium to long run, the Muslim Brotherhood has to be legalized and regulated. I don't know how many people have told me in the past few months, oh, the Muslim Brotherhood is a legitimate political party. Well, no, it's not. It's neither is it a political party. It's a secret society and a cult-like organization. It has a political party attached to it, the Freedom and Justice Party, that's regulated and open. But it itself is operating in secret, and that's because it was repressed, and many Egyptian governments wanted it that way, but it's also because the Brotherhood preferred it that way. So the Brotherhood needs to be brought out into the open, and that's an onus both on the Egyptian government and on the Brotherhood leaders, and I think that's going to be a crucial stepping stone, and I think we should push for that as much as we can. So is there a point? Yes, and you know, I'll certainly know it when I see it. And I don't think it's crossed the threshold yet. I'm in a minority in Washington. I was in a very small minority when I wrote my article. I'm in a much less small minority now. And I think as time goes on, depending on what happens, I may find myself in an even less of a minority. In the sense, not that I want the U.S. not to do anything, but that I think that the Obama administration has struck the right balance.
Yeah.
That's it.
Okay, well, you know, I mean, it's been a good discussion.
Yes, it is.
I don't think either of us is convinced the other.
No, but, and let me say, I think
this is about the
we both can agree on this though, that it's not an easy call, right?
Yeah, no, I don't think it's an easy call. Okay. But I mean, my mind is certainly made up.
Yeah, mine too. Well. Oh, absolutely. But yeah. I think as long as we can see, as long as we can agree that this is not a simple matter, then we're doing pretty well.
No, I mean, I think that it really is about, you know, it's about the balance of the, of you know, our
interests and values.
As you said, our values and our interests.
That's right.
And I think that, that, you know, I'm just.
We asked the same question.
We asked the same question. Yeah.
I'm sorry. We asked the same question and we come up with two different answers.
Yeah.
That's right.
Yeah, I think that's right.
Good conversation, Ali. Thank you.
Okay, yeah. It's a pleasure talking to Zane.
Absolutely.
Take it easy, and I look forward to
see you on the pages.